Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a wonderful pleasure to welcome Darren Altınoglu back to the LSE as the Lionel Robbins lecturer of 2004. As you can see, he's the youngest Lionel Robbins lecturer that we've had by far. He's also, I think, the only one who took his PhD at the LSE. So this is an excellent tradition which is being established here. He actually got his PhD only 11 years ago, since when he's become one of the leading economists in the world, and certainly has put almost everybody else to shame by the amount and quality of his writings. Now, let me just tell you a bit about what he's on about. He has always, from his PhD here, combined rigorous theory with serious empirical implementation. He started off with an interest in labour economics, broadening to innovation, broadening to the whole sweep of economic development, and increasingly he's come, like many economists, to regard institutions as central to that process, but institutions that in turn have to be explained. So that's the great theme of these lectures. I hope I'm describing that correctly. And the first of these lectures is going to be on institutions and the prosperity of nations. Darren will talk for about an hour, and then we'll have some questions. So Darren, welcome back to the LSE.
Thank you. Okay, I think this seems to be working. Well, thank you very much all for coming, and it's a great honor to be here for obvious reasons that this is a very significant lecture, and also it's especially a great honor and for me to be here because, as Richard said, I was a student here, and I think it's very interesting that I'm going to talk about institutions and what is sometimes referred to as political economy in the Lionel Robbins lecture, because much of the writing of Lionel Robbins was about political economy, which was, at the time, had a slightly different meaning, which was understanding of economic policies. And now I think what we are trying to do is go one step back and understand the determinants of policies, which is sometimes what is meant by institutions. And so that's what I'm going to talk about. So let's see how this is going to work. Okay. So before I go into kind of the details of the lecture, but before even I give you the outline of the talk and what I'm going to talk about, just a very sweeping statement of what I'm going to try to convince you of, which is more or less what Richard said. So I'm going to try to develop the argument in these lectures that institutions, which is just basically a short word for organization of the society, rules of the game, and anything that shapes the incentives of firms and workers and producers, are essential for understanding why some countries are poor and some countries are rich, and why some countries grow rapidly while others stagnate. And therefore, in order to understand the vast differences in prosperity across nations, we really have to think deeply about institutions. But building on that, institutions themselves are not God-given, they're not determined by nature, but they are also choices that individuals make, choices that societies make. So therefore, if we start with the perspective that institutions are important for understanding the prosperity of nations, we have to go and understand why institutions differ across countries. If institutions are so important for prosperity, why is it that some countries choose institutions that condemn them to stagnation, poverty, while others grow rapidly? And this is going to be interesting not only because it's a theoretical point, but it's also empirical, because it also relates with how do we actually understand what institutions do. And we're going to talk about, I'm going to try to talk about ways of using history in order to get insights about the role of institutions, and look at what sometimes are called natural experiments, the variations that history has thrown in our way in order to understand the effects of big variations. And And in this regard, I'm going to try to develop the argument that now I realize this is not, there is a problem, which is that the lower parts of these things are not so. Okay, so a little technical problem that we didn't notice. This, I suppose, is the problem of switching from US to the UK, I suppose, because half of my slide is gone here.
Darren, he's gone off to get them. You just carry on.
Okay. It's just a problem of adjusting this in the sense that it's not fitting into the I should have noticed this in the check. So we're going to talk about why institutions differ, and in particular develop the argument that institutions are not typically chosen for the good of society, but as a result of a struggle in society between individuals and groups with different interests, and this process is somewhat responsible for why different societies end up with different institutions, and as a result, why some societies are able to grow and not. And then in light of this, I'm going to come back and discuss various ways that we can think of institutions affecting economic outcomes, and economic outcomes in turn affecting institutions, so understanding the whole dynamic interactions between institutions and economics. And then at the very end, I'm going to talk a little bit about issues of policy reform and institutional reform, or the little that we can say about that topic. So at this point, I was going to show you the plans of the lectures, 1, 2, 3, just to be able to kind of whet your appetite and encourage you to come back, but I won't do that. So I won't do that. I will do that without showing the transparency. So basically, the first lecture, I'm going to talk about what we know at a broad brush about the effect of institutions, in particular, how do we know that institutions are so important for understanding the prosperity of nations? So I'm going to talk about institutions as a fundamental cause of the determinants of income, and then contrasting it to other major determinants of income, such as geographic differences or cultural differences. Okay, let's see. Oh, this is good. Oh, yes, this is fantastic. This is much better. Okay, thank you very much. So this is the outline plan of the first lecture. So in this context, I'm going to talk both about geography versus institutions and the role of culture. And as empirical motivation, I'm going to discuss a little bit about Korea, much about the colonial experience, and a topic that's quite interesting, you know, for a British audience, whether the British colonies were different in many ways. And then the second lecture is really building up on this and trying to think about how we can understand why institutions are different, and so towards a theory of institutions. So I'm going to just discuss what I call different meta-theories, different fundamentally different approaches to why different institutions are different. And then I'm going to go through a number of examples in order to motivate a particular approach. What I call social conflicts, or the role of social conflict. But this is really the beginning of it. The really interesting part, in my view, is the dynamics of political institutions, political power, and the interaction with economics. And then building on that, I'm going to go back to some two other examples, in particular, Atlantic trade and the rise of constitutional regimes in Europe, and then the later 19th century emergence of mass democracy in Western Europe, in order to illustrate what I have in mind with this theory of institutions. And then finally, the third lecture is going to try to put many of these things together, use history to be more rigorously try to estimate the causal effect of institutions on income as opposed to other competing factors, and also look at short-run versus long-run issues, institutions and policies, and I will also talk about pitfalls of potential institutional reform. So that's the outline, and this is the lecture one again. Now, going back into lecture one, so the fact that's motivating this whole approach is an obvious one, and one that many social scientists from very different approaches have strived to understand. There are just tremendous differences in prosperity across countries. It's even difficult for us living in the Western world to understand the poverty that many nations are in. And if you think about it, the average income per capita in sub-Saharan Africa, which is of course the poorest part of the world, is about 1/20 of the income of the United States, regular United States, average United States citizen. In fact, that's the average. If you go to some of the poorer nations in sub-Saharan Africa, such as Mali, Congo, Ethiopia, Zaire, you see levels of income less than 1/35 of the income of in United States citizens. So those are just staggering differences, and a first order question is to understand why. And of course, I am coming to this question from economics, and there are standard economic answers. And those economic answers are extremely useful. And when we look at United States society and compare it to India or compare it to Ethiopia or compare it to any of these other societies that are not as rich or that are not growing or have not grown as much, we can pinpoint to some major factors. We can say, well, there are big physical capital differences. A typical worker in sub-Saharan Africa works with a trivial amount of physical capital and a much lower quality physical capital than a worker in the United States, and that's generally going to be associated with less output. And also workers in these countries have much lower levels of education. A typical American worker has 12 years of schooling. Whatever you might think about the American education system, and many people in Europe don't think much, that's still 12 years of formal education where you learn a lot. When you go to Africa, most people have 0 years of schooling. I mean, that's just a big difference. Or technology. It's not just that they have less schooling, less stuff. It's just that they don't have access to the most advanced technology, and more importantly, they are not organizing production in the most efficient way. So even with physical capital and human capital differences, we cannot go all the way, and it seems that things are being done much more inefficiently in some of the poorer countries than they are in the more advanced countries like the United Kingdom or the US. But at some level, just relying on these standard economic answers is highlighting the mechanisms that actually explain differences in income. But they don't really answer questions about the fundamental causes. So at some level, we can call these proximate causes because they are the mechanisms through which poverty is being produced in less developed countries. But they're not the fundamental causes because there's one more level of answer. Why is it that there is so little physical capital? Why is it that people don't save or there isn't more capital going? Why isn't there more investment in education? Why is it that they don't have access to the best technologies? Why is it that available technologies are not being used in the most efficient form? And in order to answer that question, we have to turn to what we might refer to as fundamental causes of differences in prosperity. There must be something in the background that makes these countries not invest as much, not be organized as efficiently. And although you might say it's luck, it just happened that way, that's not a very compelling explanation. And you're going to go back to one of the three broad explanations for this fact. Either, and this is the one I'm going to focus on and try to convince you that is where a lot of the action is, institutions. Humanly devised rules that really affect individuals and in some places encourage them to invest and encourage them to be efficient, in other places just condemns them to poverty via the effects on incentives. But another possibility is geography. There are some exogenous differences across these places. Climate differs, natural resources differ, and these could well be an important factor. Perhaps if you are in a tropical area, you cannot be as rich. That's a possibility. We have to think about that. Or culture. Nowadays, very, 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 very popular. You know. There, many people talk about the importance of culture, importance of attitudes, importance of beliefs, especially in this day and age where, you know, after Sam Huntington's book of The Clash of Civilizations, that's just an important area for us to think about. So which of these are the most fruitful area for us to go? Of course, they're not mutually exclusive, but which one is the most promising area for us to go? So, since I'm going to be talking about the importance of institutions, I have to say a little bit more about institutions. And that's one of the problems, and it's a problem that I'm not going to I'm not going to resolve and give you an extremely precise definition of institutions. But at this point, I'm going to leave it even more loose than it needs to be. Because to make it more specific, that's in some sense the job that I will take on in the second lecture. But for now, let's think of a relatively broad definition of institutions. I'm going to take institutions to be the rules of the game in economics, in economic, political, and social interactions. So broadly, the social organization of society. Douglas North, who won the Nobel Prize largely because of his economic history work emphasizing the importance of institutions, defined them as the rules of the game in a society, more formally, the humanly devised constraints that shape human interaction. And I think this short statement has a lot in it, because it emphasizes that institutions are humanly devised. They are different from geography. They're not outside human control. They are, in fact, even different from culture, because culture, we think of it as beliefs and attitudes that are not really directly controlled by individuals either. They set constraints. If the society says you cannot do this action, you cannot take this action, you cannot write this kind of contract, or you cannot go and take my property away, that's a set of institutions. Those are the constraints. And most importantly, they shape human interaction, or I would like to phrase it as they shape incentives. The key role that, for me, institutions are going to play is that they are going to affect the incentives of firms, workers, and other economic and political actors. At this level, this is a very broad cluster. There are lots of things in it. If you want to think of democracy, that's an institution. If you want to think of contract law, what type of contracts you can write, what kind of procedures you have to go through for bankruptcy, that's an institution. It does set constraints, and it does shape incentives. So it's useful to think of what the sub-levels are, and I would like to think of economic institutions, for example, property rights contracts and enforcement, which are important for economic incentives, and political institutions, for example, form of government, constraints on politicians or separation of power, democracy or not, which are going to be important for shaping political incentives. And also it's useful to think of formal institutions, which are things like in the constitutions that are written down, but they might also be informal institutions, which are how that constitution is actually implemented in practice. After all, as many people know, US, like many Latin American countries, has a presidential system and constitution that's very similar, but in many cases it's actually implemented very differently. So we might want to think of that as part of the thing. So one of the elements when we think of what else is in institutions other than formal institutions, this element, the distribution of political power, already pops up. And this is going to be the topic that I'm going to spend a lot of time in the second lecture. So when we look across the world, we see a lot of big differences in income per capita. That was the first slide. But equally, we see big differences in institutions. Look at enforcement of property rights. The way, however you measure it, you're going to see enormous differences. If you go to a sub-Saharan African country, like Democratic Republic of Congo under Mobutu, you will see almost no enforcement of property rights, and the government or some other parties can come and take whatever you have. Hence, investment was very low, one might argue, and we'll see. Whereas in other countries, property rights are very firmly enforced. Legal systems, rules that people function under are very, very different. Corruption, big differences across country. Entry barriers, again, big differences across country. Democracy versus dictatorship, the way that countries are governed are just fundamentally different that we see. And so the question is this institutional variation in some way related to this vast differences in income per capita that we have seen? If you want to develop the argument that they are related, the first thing you might want to do is let's see whether they are correlated. Let's see whether countries that have different degrees of enforcement of property rights are richer or poorer than others. So here is a figure that you might start with. There are many different measures of property right enforcement, and many of them have problems that they are subjective and people might look at outcomes, etc. But still, it's a useful place to start. So here, this is a measure developed by Political Risk Services, which is an international consulting firm that sells this information. So you might think it might have some content in it. So since people are paying money in order to find out whether their investments are going to be taken up or not. And look at this measure of property rights versus income per capita. So that's a measure that we care about, vast differences in prosperity. It's also a pretty good measure of long-run economic performance. If you say that a country has done very well over the past 100 years, that's the country that has a relatively high income per capita. And what you see is that there is, in fact, a correlation. The countries that have poor enforcement of property rights are at the bottom here. They are the ones that have low income per capita. And the countries that have strict enforcement of property rights are at the top. This type of correlation is also what you see at look at other measures. So here is another one, which is control of corruption. So those countries down here are the ones that have high corruption. So you can see Ecuador, Dominican Republic, Ukraine, Kenya, Zambia, a lot of the African countries. The countries up top here are the ones that you saw at the top, more or less, are the ones that you saw at the top of the other measure. They are the Western European countries and some other places like Hong Kong, Israel. So those are the ones that control corruption, and they also happen to be rich. And here is a political variable. This is constraints on the executive, meaning what type of constraints, separation of powers, or democratic competition are the executives are subject to. And again, a similar story. Those who have the highest score, which is 7, and that's why there's a bunching up there, are the ones that are rich. And those that don't seem to have constrained executive, like Ghana, Syria, Swaziland, Rwanda, are the ones that are at the bottom. So what do we conclude from this? Well, there is a correlation, but correlation is not going to be enough. And the reason why correlation is not going to be enough is because institutions are endogenous. And that's the theme that I would like to come back to over and over again during these lectures. These institutions are not determined by nature. They're not given by God, but they are humanly devised. These societies decided for one reason or another, or ended up for one reason or another, with different sets of institutions. So the question is, why do they have different institutions? And if once we admit that they have different sets of institutions, whatever was leading to their differences might also be responsible for the differences in performance. So perhaps countries have different institutions because they have different geographies. Perhaps they have because they have different cultures. Perhaps for some other reasons, they just end up with different institutions. And in fact, a very respectable set of social scientists have pushed the view that any of these factors, or some of these factors, any meaning there is a social scientist or a philosopher claiming that that factor is the driving force of the big differences in income per capita. And often, if they are creative enough, they have also come up with some story for why these societies might have other differences, not only in their economic performance, but also in the way that they organize society. And perhaps one of the most distinguished is the brilliant French philosopher of the 18th century, Montesquieu, who was a wonderful man for his emphasis on republican forms of government and his arguments against despotism. But he also had other arguments. He thought that geography was a key determinant of human attitudes. And he thought human attitudes determined both economic performance and the political system. In fact, he thought that people who live in warm climate, here's this, are so devoid of energy that they become totally useless for production, and they in turn deserve to be governed by despots. So Montesquieu was therefore advancing a theory in which this heat of the climate was a key determinant of human attitudes and economic performance, and at the same time was a determinant of institutions. So if we have this possibility that geography or culture, which I'm going to come back to in a little bit, is a key determinant of both institutions and economic performance, we have an identification problem. There is some omitted variable or potential reverse causality, and we can learn only very little from correlations or ordinary least squares estimates. So how can we make progress? And you might think, well, perhaps I shouldn't take this arguments about the heat of the climate that seriously, but it's not only Montesquieu 200 years ago. Many people today are developing similar arguments, and quite effectively. Jared Diamond, who was the author of the best-selling Guns, Germs, and Steel, precisely developed an argument of geographic determinism, where geographic and ecological differences determine both economic performance and institutional social organizational differences. Jeff Sachs and the World Health Organization and many other people are very much convinced that the big difference across countries is actually in geography, but in other elements of geography. So for example, Jeff Sachs states that economies in tropical ecozones are everywhere, almost everywhere, poor, and there is a causal connection there. And he goes around to By the way, he was a previous giver of a Lionel Robbins lecture, so what more reason to quote him here at length. And geographical advantages might be natural resources, access to coastline and sea, and other things. And tropical agriculture, he argues, faces very serious problems, hence another reason for why geography will affect performance. And also a very high burden of infectious diseases. Areas in the tropical ecozones are going to be affected by worse and more damaging diseases, perhaps. And in fact, if you want to believe in Montesquieu's story, if you want to believe in Jared Diamond's story, you can find evidence for that too. So here's a similar scatter plot, but now I don't have an institutional variable on the horizontal axis. I have a geographic variable. So it's latitude, the distance of your capital from the equator, and again income per capita on the vertical axis. This time we see that countries that are near the equator in the tropical areas, like again Ecuador, Gabon, and Guyana, that are poor, and Western Europe, which tends to be farther from the equator, in the more temperate areas where the cold climate might be better, perhaps, are the rich areas. So how do we make more progress? Well, in the same way as we had a problem with the correlation between institutions, so various measures of institutions and income per capita, there's a similar problem with geography. We should just not make much of these kind of correlations. The omitted variable biases, the reverse causality, are just going to create problems for us in making inferences. Sure, reverse causality may not be a problem with institutions, with geography, since geography is clearly not caused by income per capita. But the omitted variable biases is still there. Perhaps there are some other factors that are, for some other reasons, correlated with geography that are the real determinants of income per capita, and people are just wrong in jumping to conclusions about the effects of hot climates and seas and stuff. So what can we do? If we cannot make much progress with the correlations, how can we learn more? What I'm going to argue is that we can learn much more by trying to exploit a source of exogenous variation. So if there are some reasons for why one of the factors that we care about, for example institutions, vary across countries for reasons unrelated to other fundamental causes, that will give us a window of opportunity to learn about the causal effect, to learn about the potential impact of these institutional variables. This is the kind of strategy that you would adopt if you wanted to do a controlled experiment in physical sciences. Of course, controlled experiments are not possible in economics, and when we look at institutions, political economy, the big general equilibrium stuff, we're not going to be able to learn much at all from a strategy of controlled experiments. However, fortunately or unfortunately, fortunately from a scientific point of view, unfortunately for the people who lived it, history offers natural experiments, meaning instances, historical junctures, where otherwise similar societies went through different paths for reasons unrelated to other potential determinants of income. And in exploiting these type of natural experiments, we can learn much more. So here I'll talk briefly about two or perhaps three of these, depending on how much time I have. The first one is, you might think of, is the Korean experiment. So as you very well know, Korea is now split into two, North and South Korea, two very different parts, two very different organizations. But at the end of the Second World War, Korea was actually economically, culturally, and ethnically quite homogeneous. If you want to look at the differences between North and South, if anything, the North was slightly more industrialized, especially in heavy industry. And what happened at that point? Well, the two parts went their different ways. But they didn't go different ways because they made a choice, meaning people said, well, it's better for us to be organized this way. But they went because of the power play of the global world at that time, that this was imposed on them by a deal between Russia and the United States, and the North became a communist centrally planned economy, and the South more capitalist economy with a market economy, although there's a lot of government intervention, as we well know, although it wasn't democratic at first, something that's much more similar to what we think of as a capitalist economy. This is exogenous, according to this usage of the term that I'm adopting here, because institutional outcomes were not related to economic, cultural, or geographic conditions in the North and the South. It was just imposed not because of the needs of the North and the South, but because of what was happening outside Korea. And it's approximating an experiment because different parts are subject to different treatment. What do we see in the institutions? Well, we have these big differences, the capitalism and communism, and so we can kind of ask the question, do these big exogenous differences in institutions translate into big differences in economic outcome? And the answer is yes. According to the existing estimates, North and the South were similar in 1950 and probably up to the early, the late 1960s. But from then on, there was a big process of divergence, and today much of North Korea is in famine and poverty, and the South Korea is one of the richer countries of the world. So at least this single example gives us a sense that when we look at really big differences in institutions, communism and central planning, and a very dictatorial system versus a relatively capitalist economy, those things have big effects. But of course, it's not a great evidence by itself. First of all, when you do a controlled experiment in physical sciences, you don't have just two subjects, one treated, one untreated, many, many. So we'd like to know whether there was something special about this case. And also, we really don't care so much only about capitalism versus socialism, or capitalism versus communism, but we care about much more refined differences in institutions. So when you have a capitalist economy where politicians are very powerful and elites are very powerful, does that make a difference? So for that, we need to look at richer experiments. So another potential natural experiment, I will argue, is the Europeans' colonization of the rest of the world. Starting in the late 15th century, Europeans rose to the position of global dominance, conquering or directly influencing much of the rest of the world over the next 400 years or even longer. And this was a discontinuous event in the sense that prior to that, Europeans had much less influence on the rest of the world because they had not discovered the New World and they had not discovered how to go to the Indian Ocean through the Cape of Good Hope. So there was a clear turning date. And moreover, it is potentially approximating a natural experiment because many factors, including geographic, ecological, climatic, or even perhaps cultural factors, were not directly affected. But it was first and foremost institutions, and then other factors started changing. So the question is, how can we look at the consequences? Well, there are many ways we can look at it. But one thing that would be very interesting is to ask, well, once the Europeans started dominating the rest of the world, how did the economic fortunes of the places that they conquered change after that? Well, if we were asking that question, say, between 1960 and 1990, we would turn to national accounts. And of course, for 1500, we don't have national accounts. So how can we judge whether these countries were prosperous or not? Well, fortunately, even though we don't have national accounts, we have measures of prosperity. It turns out that a pretty good measure of economic prosperity, especially before the age of globalization, is urbanization. This is a point that a number of economic historians have already made. Kuznets, Bayrock, and De Vries are probably the most distinguished among those. And the reasoning is that only societies which agricultural surplus and a sufficiently good transportation or perhaps trading network would be able to support a large fraction of their population living in cities. You remember, we are thinking of pre-industrial times. It was pretty expensive and difficult to take half of your population away from food production and put them in cities. So there is at least a theoretical reason along the lines of suggested by Kuznet and De Vries and Bayrock that we might expect urbanization to be a good proxy. But moreover, even today, there is a very strong correlation between urbanization and GDP per capita. So here on the horizontal axis, I have urbanization today, and in the vertical axis, income per capita today. Well, today being 1995, following a little bit later than today. And the same countries that are poor are also the ones that have low levels of urbanization. So again, in line with my speech about correlations, this is not a causal statement at all. Nobody in their right mind would argue that when you increase urbanization, this is going to, you know, when you force people to go to cities, this is going to increase income. But it's just a statement that the two seem to be positively associated, so perhaps we could use urbanization as a proxy for income. And fortunately, we can form some good estimates of urbanization even in 1500, even going back earlier because of the works of archaeologists, historians, and others. And if we look at what happened to urbanization before 1500, persistence is the state of the world. If you had an area that was relatively urbanized, look at it 100 years later, 200 years later, 300 years later, it tended to be more urbanized. Of course, cities rose and fell. Even areas rose and fell. So you can think of this as mean reversion in the same sense as Galton's. If your father is tall, your kid is going to be a little bit shorter. But persistence was the norm. And if you look at, and I'm not going to show you this data because, you know, I only have so much time. The data that we can gather from the historians confirms this pattern. So against this background of persistence in prosperity, what do we see after the European intervention? What do we see after the European national experiment? The answer is the opposite of persistence, what we call reversal. Actually, I just realized that in that whole thing that my slides weren't showing, I forgot to say that the work that I'm presenting here is in part joint with two very distinguished people, which I forgot to mention, and I don't want to take all the credit or the blame. So Simon Johnson and James Robinson, who are both English, actually. So that gives me credit for being tough on British colonies later on. And also, Jim was a student of Lionel Robbins at the LSE a long time ago. So that was just going back to the beginning. I didn't want you to think that I was taking too much credit or blame or whatever. So coming back to our reversal, which is the name that Jim, Simon, and I kind of coined for this, we have urbanization in 1500 on the horizontal axis, and again our friend income per capita here on the vertical axis. But now we see something quite remarkable. The societies that were more urbanized in 1500, which I will argue were those that were relatively prosperous at the time, are those that are relatively poor today. So Ecuador, Peru, those were relatively developed civilizations. If you compare them to what the area that is now the United States, which was basically semi-nomadic or hunter-gatherer societies, they were much more settled with a well-developed agricultural system, trading network, and all. The same thing true for India, Indonesia, and North Africa. Here, you have countries that were relatively unurbanized: United States, Canada, Australia, Chile, Argentina, Venezuela, Uruguay, Brazil. Now, urbanization data is quite noisy, and we can't get it for every country because, you know, what you can do. There's some limits. But the same argument for urbanization applies to something that we can measure even better, and that's population density. In the same way as you need some level of development, some level of agricultural productivity, good trading networks to support urbanized populations, you also need it to support dense populations relative to arable areas. And when you look at the picture, you see the same thing with population density with many more observations. Again, areas that were more densely settled in 1500, which we think were richer, are the ones that are poorer. So therefore, in our hands, we have something quite interesting. We have what we refer to as a reversal. We have a process in which among the former colonies, among the places that later came to be dominated and colonized and conquered by the Europeans, those that were relatively rich somehow through some process ended up relatively poor. Now, it's not an absolute statement. It's not all of these societies today are much richer than they were before. Even Democratic Republic of Congo, though I think there it's pretty close. And it's not a statement about, you know, colonialism being good or bad. Here I am simply comparing among the former colonies. So I'm not comparing them to a country that wasn't colonized by the Europeans. A few of them, they were. So it's a process that was going among the colonies that somehow led to this reversal, that the relatively rich became relatively poor, the relatively poor became the relatively rich. And I keep saying relatively, because it's not that nobody came poorer over time. How did this happen? Why did this happen? Well, I think thinking about that is going to give us a lot of insights. But before, about the how and why, you might also ask, when did this happen? 500 years we're talking here. Did it happen immediately when the Europeans colonized these places? Because they plundered. Yes, they did plunder. You know, they took the gold out of Central and Mesoamerica. They took the. They plundered India. So perhaps it was the plunder. Perhaps it was the fact that when Europeans went to some of these places, like, again, Central America and the Aztecs and the Incas, they brought their diseases, smallpox and measles, and they killed a large fraction of the population. So did it happen immediately as the Europeans colonized it? Did it happen in a scattered way through time? The answer is no. It happened at a very specific point in time, which is the 19th century. So this line here is urbanization in the average urbanization in previously high urbanization places. So those were the places, those are like those here. And then, blue line here is the ones at the top. So like the United States and Australia and all of these places. And what you can see is that these places were more urbanized for a long, long time. So this is my persistence that I was mentioning. And they remained more urbanized, even though there's a big blip here. This is when the populations of the Central America and so on were decimated by the diseases that Europeans brought. But the real takeoff happens in the 19th century. Why in the 19th century? The answer to that is also seems to be quite clear. It's industrialization. What really went on in the 19th century is that the previously sparsely settled, the previously poor colonies, or former colonies, because some of them had already gained their independence, like the North American colonies, industrialized very rapidly. And during the 19th century, during this period of industrialization, that was the engine of growth. If you look at increase in agricultural output in the United States in the 19th century, it is small, relatively small, compared to the increase in industrial output. And this figure here gives you a sense of that. So at this point where our data starts, 1750, India produced more industrial output, more textiles, than United States. So you can't see it quite, but India is here, United States is here. In fact, almost twice as much per capita. But India basically remained constant. In fact, India declined, industrial output per capita, to the best of the estimates, declined from 1750 to about mid-19th century, and then increased some. Whereas the United States just shot. Same thing for Mexico, same thing for the other previously densely settled and highly urbanized places. So therefore, we have some handle on what's happening. We know it happened. Well, we can talk about it, but we believe it happened, and we've documented it in a number of ways. And this is not just data. If you look at the historians' accounts, it's entirely consistent with it. We know when it happened, and we have some clue about how it happened in the sense of approximate cause. It happened in a way related to industrialization. Of course, when we say previously poor societies, sparsely societies benefited, we don't mean that their indigenous people benefited. You know, we have to bear in mind that the gains in these growing societies were not equally shared, and there were many people who lost much more than perhaps in places like India, the native Indians and aborigines in the New World, who have all disappeared as a result of European colonization. But the area as a whole became much richer, while the people and the areas of South America, the Indian subcontinent, parts of Africa, have not grown to the same degree. How can we explain it? What type of hypothesis? Well, we can go back to the geography hypothesis. We saw Montesquieu said, warm places, they make you lazy, they make you poor. Jeff Sachs said, tropical areas almost on everywhere are poor. Well, we look at the data, that's not true. they were actually quite prosperous, relatively speaking. These are the tropical areas. It's only that they didn't keep up with the industrialization and the growth process. Well, that's a simple geography hypothesis. That's why there's a simple here around it. Perhaps you can come up with a more sophisticated one where you say, well, there are some geographic characteristics that are good for you or okay for you at some stage, and then they become a burden later on. Perhaps heat is okay for when you are working the land, and it's bad for industrialization. But when you look at it, when you look at regression analysis, etc., you find no evidence for it. This was not related to any geographic characteristics. It's not related to latitude, it's not related to temperature, humidity, natural resources, access to sea. It's something else. What is it? Well, leaving the culture issue aside for another 5 minutes, I will argue it's institutions. Europeans took over the rest of the world, but they didn't do it in the same way. They didn't impose the same institutions in every part of the world. In fact, there is a tremendous amount of difference in the institutions that Europeans brought, and this difference in institutions was related to their colonization strategies. Europeans pursued a variety of different objectives in their colonization. And some places, colonization was just a mean of extracting resources. Silver, gold, sugar, slaves. In others, Europeans set up either trading or production posts, or they went and settled themselves, building a society based on the image of Western Europe that surpassed Western Europe in many dimensions of democracy and freedom, and also economic institutions and economic freedoms. So this was related to their colonization strategies, and different colonization strategies came with different institutions. When they were interested in slavery, forced labor, extracting resources, they brought institutions that were top-down, concentrating power in the hands of a few. When they went and settled themselves, for a variety of reasons which I will discuss in greater detail as we go along, they set up very different institutions, early on much more democratic than anywhere else in the world, and certainly much more than in South America or the Indian subcontinent or Africa. So in other words, as the comparison of, say, the United States, which was sparsely settled, to Peru, which was densely settled, or to Caribbean, or Canada and Australia, which was non-urbanized, to India, which was highly urbanized at the time of colonization, would suggest, there was an institutional reversal. The areas that were more densely settled and richer at the time of European colonization were the ones that got worse institutions. And for a variety of reasons, which will be the heart of our theory of institutions, those institutions persisted. So here is a graph that shows the relationship between urbanization and the institutions at the time of independence, and the same thing with population density. The more urbanized and more densely settled you were, the measures of institutions like the constraint on the executive that I pointed out were worse at the time of colonization. And the reversal was, I will argue in greater detail, but I might as well say it now, was causally related. The reversal in prosperity was causally related to the institutional reversal. Countries with better institutions prospered, and those that had the worst institutions didn't. And moreover, for reasons that will become clear as we go along, many of the theories, many of the plausible theories for why institutions differed and how institutions affect are going to be consistent with the view that, with the fact that the big divergence happened in the 19th century in the age of industrialization. So going back to the North Korea versus South Korea, this is now not about communism versus planned economy versus capitalism. But we are talking about which type of capitalism, because all of the colonies from the get-go were capitalistic. But they were very different types of capitalism. But why? Why would the Europeans set up worse institutions in some places and better institutions in others? And why would these worse institutions persist even after independence? So those are the questions we need to discuss. And also, what do these good, bad institutions mean? Is there like kind of standard institutions that's always good and always bad. So those are the things we need to discuss. But before doing that, there are a couple of questions that might come into your head. Well, perhaps it's just the British colonies. You know, we're in England after all. And United States, Australia, Singapore, and Hong Kong, those are all British colonies. So perhaps there was something special about British colonies, as very influential people like Adam Smith and Winston Churchill, and more recently Niall Ferguson, have argued. Perhaps there is something bad about the Spanish and the French influence. The answer is no. If you look at the British colonies, the same thing happened among the British colonies. The British were as ruthless in the Caribbean as the Spanish and the French were, and the British Caribbean colonies are very poor today. If you look at population density and put Africa in there, it's the same thing. So the reversal is there within the British colonies, and when we compare British colonies in similar places to French or Spanish colonies, they behave the same. So you might think, well, perhaps there is something to do with culture. Perhaps Europeans brought different types of cultures. After all, we're talking of North America, where the Europeans settled, and I mentioned that as an important argument. So perhaps that's what's going on. Perhaps Europeans just left the culture in India, in Africa, the same, and they brought their own more growth-enhancing culture in some places. That could be an alternative explanation. So perhaps in dismissing geography, I shouldn't be dismissing the other alternative fundamental determinant, culture. Well, what is culture? That's kind of a hard question, because at some level, culture is everything we don't quite understand. But I tend to think of it as a relatively fixed characteristic of a group or a nation. For example, especially those affecting beliefs and preferences. The best example of this would be kind of religion. So religion affects your beliefs, your preferences, what type of things you want to do. And there are obvious reasons, going back to Max Weber, why differences in religious beliefs and religious attitudes could have a first-order effect on economic performance. Of course, it's useful to distinguish this from informal institutions, like why is it that constitutions are implemented differently in Latin America and the United States? Well, it could be because of culture. Perhaps in Latin America there isn't a culture of democracy. Or it could be because there are other humanly devised rules which are not in the constitutions. There are other things, there are other balances in society between groups. So it's important to distinguish those things. So I'm going to stick to culture as meaning things that affect beliefs and preferences and religion. And in particular, I'm going to look at, as we go along, into various things to do with religion and beliefs as potential determinants of economic performance. But for now, it's useful to look at whether this reversal that I showed you is related in some way to just European settling. So let me skip that and look at the reversal and for the colonies with less than 1% of the Europeans. So these are colonies that exclude places like the United States, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, where Europeans settled in large numbers. Those are places that Europeans did not settle, but nevertheless followed different colonization policies. And you see a similar reversal in those places. You have places like Botswana are at the top, Malaysia are high up there, and others that were much richer at the time of European colonization are at the bottom. And you see the same picture if you look at places that are today non-European. So now you get Singapore and Hong Kong up there with very little fraction of Europeans there. So there isn't a direct effect of Europeans or direct effect of European culture. There is something else underlying this reversal. Well, finally, let me mention a few things about the Chinese experience. Because you might think that just showing that there was a reversal among places that Europeans did not settle is not sufficient to kind of dismiss culture. And I don't want to dismiss culture. But nevertheless, it's useful to develop the argument a little bit more that culture wasn't it, in the sense that it wasn't the major driving force. And for that, let's look at the Chinese experience, where China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan, they have many, many cultural ethnic similarities. But they have followed extremely different trajectories. And when you look at it, It's very much related, not to culture, but to the institutions. The thing that distinguished Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan was their economic system. And when China, finally after Mao's death and the 1978 reforms, started changing its institutions, it also started growing at the same rate or similar rates to Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan. So again, this is an area where I need to say much more, and I don't quite have the time, but the effect of culture seems to be secondary to the institutions. And let me stop there as kind of the end of the first lecture and to take questions.
Wonderful start. Who wants to ask the first question?
I wonder whether you would say how you think Russia fits into your model.
Sorry?
Russia. It's rather a special case, isn't it?
Certainly, in the sense that it is entirely outside the analysis because of this quantitative analysis in the sense that it wasn't an overseas colony of European powers. But I think Russia, at some loose level, is quite indicative of the problems of institutions in the sense that relative to other former socialist countries that have made the transition, it has not adopted a set of institutions that are democratic and that do constrain the power of elites and oligarchs, which is a topic that will be the heart of my second lecture. And in that sense, it's not at some level surprising that they are having the economic problems that Eastern Europe is not having.
Next question? Don't be shy.
I was wondering, when you mentioned about institutions and how those places which were much urbanized and relatively more prosperous before the 19th century have become more poorer, and I was wondering whether you have worked on looking at institutions before the 19th century in those places which made them more prosperous and more richer, and how the new institutions after the colonies have come moved in kind of fundamentally broke with that principle. If you could comment on that.
Yes, I think it's an excellent question. And and to tell you the truth, I haven't as much. And partly the reason, for three reasons. And I think these reasons are informative about the answers to your question, I believe. First of all, it's very difficult to understand what the exact institutions of these places were, because we don't have as good measures of their institutions as we do, say, for the 19th century, you know, how politics was organized in the 19th century. So, for instance, the data I was showing for the institutional reversal was coming from the data set that political scientists have put together, which starts in the 19th century. The second reason, which is much more important, is that at some level, none of these had good institutions that we would recognize today. The Incas and the Aztecs were extremely hierarchical. Human rights didn't mean anything. They were dictatorial. They had human sacrifice. And a lot of the surplus that was created was extracted from the people in the tribute system that was then transferred to the cities and to the palaces. And in fact, the theory that I'm going to develop as applied to the European colonialism experience is going to be about the continuation of some of these tribute tax systems in the former colonies like the Incas and the Aztecs or the Indian subcontinent. So in that sense, it wasn't that any of these places had wonderful institutions. So there was something else that made some of them rich, some of them not so rich. And there was clearly some geographic element to it. The places that were richer were those that had arable land that could support a large population, it could support a hierarchical structure that was beyond the hunter-gatherer or the semi-nomadic stages. But why there and why not somewhere else? And I think there was a large element of chance to that, but it's difficult to kind of statistically or econometrically establish that. So after all, when humans first came to North America, to America, they came through North America. And they settled in some of these places in the north. And there were many civilizations that were beyond the semi-nomadic stage in the north, in the Mississippi Valley, for example. But the major growth area happened to be in Mesoamerica and Central America. So why is that? I don't know.
I'd like to ask you, which is more important? Is it the type of institution a country has, or is it the use that it makes of it? Just to be more specific, we have a number of communist countries with standard communist institutions, communist party, and so on. Some perform very badly, like the Soviet Union. Some perform well, like China. We have a number of countries with parliamentary systems. Some perform much better than others. We have countries with trade unions, which I hope is an institution you'll refer to in the course of the other lectures. And there are good trade union systems and bad ones. So ultimately, are we going to come down to the fact that some countries are specific cases? Are we going to have to rely on history, the way countries use their institutions, rather than the fact of being part of a broad category of institutions?
Thank you very much for that. I think that's a great question, because, and it comes partly to the issue that I am being quite non-specific about what institutions are. So if you think that I define institutions as constitutions, it should come back to the way that how countries use their institutions. Because you see the same constitution declaring an independent judiciary in Argentina and the United States, and Perón, when he comes to power, can replace all the judges in the Supreme Court and put his people. Frankly, Roosevelt, FDR cannot do the same. So clearly, the same rules that were on paper were implemented very differently, and they had very different consequences. In the United States, the policies of FDR were slowed down, and in Argentina, Perón went full steam ahead. So the question is, am I going to just talk about formal institutions that are on paper? I think that would be too restrictive. I think we really have to understand, when we talk of institutions, not only what is written on paper, but how it's implemented. So in some sense, according to your usage, I would say we have to understand how institutions are used, but I would prefer the term that I define the whole humanly devised rules that shape human incentives as a set of institutions. So they include how political power is distributed, for example, in society. So what enabled Perón to get rid of the judges is that there was a very different distribution of political power and very different set of other auxiliary institutions around the Constitution that didn't allow a U.S. president to overstep the Constitution. But of course, at the end, the proof of the pudding is the eating. We have to come up with a relatively concrete set of measures of institutions and how they change. And I'm not going to be able to do all of that, but I hope to do some more. I hope to make some more progress towards that end tomorrow.
You gave sub-Saharan Africa as your major example of contemporary poverty. You mentioned sub-Saharan Africa as an example of the reversal with regard to population density, i.e. that sub-Saharan Africa is characterized by relatively low population densities at the end of the colonial period. But you admitted to mention that sub-Saharan Africa had experienced massive growth of population in the 20th century, including in the late colonial period, and is generally regarded as having had distinctively low population densities in earlier periods, to the extent that one can say very much about it. But of course, it's important to say a lot about it, because it is, on the face of it, your central example.
Thank you. Well, coming back to this figure, a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, according to the best estimates that are available, which is according to McEvedy and Jones, they have been updated, but quite consistent on the sub-Saharan Africa part, are in the medium and relatively high population density area. And part of the reason is that, well, I'm defining population density with respect to arable land. So Sahara Desert, of course, is out. If you put the Sahara Desert, that's a different matter, but in the Sahara Desert, there's basically no possibility of agriculture. So Zimbabwe, for example, is relatively medium population density. But when you look at places like Burundi and Rwanda, they have always been very highly densely settled. So in that sense, your statement that it was not densely settled before the colonial era, at least these data are not consistent with that. And so in that sense, it's a reversal, including sub-Saharan Africa. But the previous figure here, which is urbanization, does not have sub-Saharan Africa in it, because we don't have any good measures of urbanization for sub-Saharan Africa. We know bits and pieces about particular places. For example, Nigeria and Mali were very highly urbanized, and important big cities like Yoruba, Igbo, and Timbuktu and others in Mali. But that's just scattered information, and we don't have the same systematic evidence that we do. But this figure, which does exclude sub-Saharan Africa, shows that the reversal is independent of whether you have sub-Saharan Africa or not, and that's in much greater detail documented, and there's a statistical analysis in the work that underlies this talk. But in this figure here, sub-Saharan Africa is there, and it's in here, not far from the regression line, so to speak.
Up here, hello. my question is regarding the I'm not very clear on your distinction between culture and informal institutions. I mean, they did say something about it towards the end, but it didn't really convince me. And I guess I'm thinking, for example, of another example. I mean, you mentioned North and South Korea. I'm thinking of Northern and Southern Italy, for example, mm-hmm. as in the case of that Putnam studied. Mm-hmm. And you have a case where formal institutions are clearly the same, but there are striking differences in economic performance. And would you ascribe those to informal institutions or to culture? I mean, I'm interested in sort of if you could elaborate a little bit more about how you distinguish between culture and informal institutions.
I think that's an excellent question. Thank you. I think it's very difficult to distinguish between them. So the way that I try to do it is basically by arbitrarily drawing the line somewhere. And the way I did it is, I tried to put everything that affects beliefs and preferences, like religion, like whether your parents teach you to be cooperative or not, and how altruistic to be towards others, in culture. But how other relations in society work and shape incentives in informal institutions. In the case of North versus South of Italy, I think it's a very difficult case, and I'm not an expert on it. But clearly, religion is roughly similar, but there might be other elements of cultural differences. And that's a thesis that goes back to Banfield and others and Putnam. They are there, but there are also differences in historical informal institutions. Land relations and the power of land owners was very different. And if, in general, if we look at just formal national institutions, we would be throwing a lot of the variation in institutions out. So again, in India, there are tremendous differences across the regions, and they are all under one unified constitution. But when you go to the historical experience, they have gone through different land systems, they have gone through different types of colonization, some of them through under direct British control, some of them under protectorate of princely states. They have had different types of land relations, some of them with the zamindari system that were kind of a tribute system going back to the British, some of them leaving the land system more or less the same. And those have necessarily led to different distributions of political power and different implementation of policies. And as a result, when you look at how education systems work, there are big differences. How redistribution works in districts or states, there are big differences. And I think a lot of this are humanly devised, and they are historically determined processes that we can understand and potentially change. And in that sense, I think they should be part of informal institutions. If they are simply part of the beliefs of the people, I think it's much harder to change, and that's where I think it's useful to draw the line. But I think it's an extremely important area to be much clearer than I have been, and it's an extremely interesting area empirically to investigate these issues. Thank you.
First part of my question, when you say that British colonialism established different types of institutions, some better than others, are you saying that in the case of Africa, which you've made frequent reference to, are you saying that yes, Europe did underdevelop Africa, and I'm referring of course to the controversy over Walter Rodney's book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And secondly, if to have economic growth, it's sufficient merely to replace bad institutions with institutions that respect property rights, then are you saying that it's possible in today's conditions of capitalism for countries to repeat the success that the East Asian tiger economies have realized? So are there not many countries which do respect property rights, but which are, in spite of that, unable to grow?
Thank you. Let me start in the same order. I think you're asking a very good but very difficult question, because it's your first question in some sense has two parts. One is, you know, really about what happened to the British colonies, what happened within the British colonies. And the second part, which is much harder, is about the overall effect of colonialism. So I am fairly confident that within the British colonies, the same things happened. If you look at British colonies, even excluding Africa, so here is, there is no Africa here, or there is no sub-Saharan Africa here, the same thing happens. So you have Malaysia, Belize, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, that's outside. Jamaica here, and then the richer places out there. And here, this picture has Africa in it as well, and as you can see, Africa fits more or less in. So this, and much more than this, the historical evidence and our reading and analysis of what happened in the process is very much consistent that whatever is happening within the British colonies is very much mirror image of what's happening for other colonies. And in the third lecture, I'm going to come back to this issue and explicitly within an econometric framework that's developed both based on this and the theoretical work, I'm going to estimate the effect of being a British colony relative to, say, being a French colony or a Spanish colony. And I can tell you now, no need for suspense, it's zero. Being a British colony is just like being a Spanish colony once you take into account the local conditions that the British have encountered. However, this is not the same as, this says nothing about the effect of being a British colony versus not being colonized whatsoever. With this methodology, nor with the methodology that I will use in the third lecture, I will not be able to answer that question. And the reason is a simple econometric one. It's not exogenous who became a colony. There was a selection process, and the places that avoided colonization, like Thailand, did so because they were able to do certain things that others didn't. But if you want to look at particular country cases, you can tell stories. So for example, Botswana, which is a country that I've looked into a little bit, is one of the most successful African countries, one of the most successful British colonies, in fact, it turns out. And it is so in part because British colonialism did not penetrate Botswana too much. The previous pre-colonial institutions lived unscathed, more or less, because the British had no interest in Botswana. However, countering that, you can also argue that if you think of the people, the native people of the Amazon or the hunter-gatherers of South Africa, if they had been in no contact whatsoever with the Europeans, they would have clearly been poorer today, because European colonization, even when it's extracted, when it's exploitative, also introduced new technologies, education systems, and so on and so forth. Not in Botswana, incidentally, but in other places. So I think there are both positives and negatives, and this empirical process is not going to be able to answer that. Regarding your second question, I think that's a very good question as well, and And this is it really comes down to what are property rights. So if we interpret property rights in the narrowest sense, no, property rights are not enough. But I'm going to argue that I'm going to interpret property rights more broadly. So for instance, if you have a society like Mexico, where property rights are very well enforced, if you mean, you know, that if you're a businessman, your money is not going to be stolen by anybody. But nevertheless, property rights more broadly defined are not that well enforced, because in order to be able to open a business, you need to get credit, and that's really hard unless you're associated with one of the really rich families or one of the banks. It's really difficult to enter if you're a newcomer in that society. So in that sense, the property rights of everybody are not enforced. The property rights of a small elite or an oligarchy is enforced. And that's very different. And I think we need to understand that, and hopefully we'll make more progress towards that in the second and the third lectures.
Last question.
Well, I think in response to one question, you did elaborate on the Indian situation, but I still want to raise the fact that other studies, for example, Clay and Walcott, have suggested that in India, the British colonization resulted in overall broad features of property rights, which were quite conducive to what could have happened to India at the time of the 19th century, and yet it did not happen. It has argued that it has very strong property rights, it had the Supreme Courts, etc., which enforce it, and it was not just as if it was a question of a small elite being done. In general, the laws were strong, and even after independence, they have been well enforced, and yet we find a different results. So that was one. The other was that when you were trying to compare about China and Singapore and Taiwan and others, and you said, well, after China took to reforms, then we see the results changing. But there have been, again, Roderick's study, which say that the one of the major contribution towards industrial growth of China was by a different kind of a property regime, and that was TVE, which was neither a completely state-owned property nor a completely private thing. It was a kind of a local ownership. And that was quite different. Mm-hmm. And yet, a big contribution came from the town and village enterprises.
Right.
So how does it come into it? And the finally, the last point was even if one goes by your settler mortality thesis and the Europeans colonizing differently, the question is, why did Europeans choose different kinds of institutions to be established? Because they didn't know what will be the result in economic terms. So there must have been something driving to choose certain kind of institutions to establish. What was those more fundamental reasons? Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much.
I want to throw in my question.
Okay.
It follows very much from that. You seem, that's a reversal proposition. You seem to be saying that even if you ignore the virtually empty countries, that wherever a country had low population density, and was therefore poorer in 1500, that somehow has had better institutions since then. Among the former colonies. But is that something you're going to explain in the next lecture?
Yes, okay, very fine. Much.
Right, so that's the answer to your third
question. So, yes, exactly. So the third question, you'll have to wait until tomorrow. The second question, you're absolutely right. And a lot of people who've worked on this, including John Macmillan, Ying-Yi Qian, and other economists and political scientists, have made our understanding of the township and village enterprises much better. And clearly, they are not capitalist property rights as we understand them. The statement was simply that they were a big improvement in incentives relative to what was there before. What was there before was a system that did not encourage people to keep any of the to invest, because they didn't keep any of the product that they produced. The township and village enterprises, even though not a capitalist form of production, they provided much better incentives. About India, I think India is one of the hardest cases, and I'm certainly not an expert about India, and there are many more in this room. But there is a very lively debate about different groups of economic historians and political scientists and historians as to what the effect of British colonialism on India was. And clearly, you know, the British did a lot of plunder at first, and then later established a system that formalized certain property rights, and the zamindari system is, for example, an example of that. The question is, did these amount to a set of institutions that encouraged investment by a broad majority of the population, that they had access or not? So the statement of one sentence that kind of sticks to my mind is from the British historian Washbrook about the Indian colony, and he says, in India, as in much of the rest of the British colonies, the British confused rule of law and rule by law, which is a statement about, yes, there was law, but that's not the same as the rule of law, in the sense that the rule of law, meaning access and protection over the rights of a majority of the population, was not quite there. Now, that's just one historian, and as you've rightly pointed out, there are many other historians who argue the British did wonderful things in India. So I think it's an empirical question. So in my work, my empirical work, I rely on the measures of others, of various measures, and India is not a central observation. So you can leave out India, the story is unchanged, and you can put back India, the story is unchanged. But I think India is a very interesting example. There's a lot of study, and by some people, the three people sitting behind you, trying to understand variation within India, and by others, which I think is extremely interesting.
Okay, well, what a wonderful beginning. Thank you so much. We have two more to go, same time tomorrow and on Wednesday, so come along and get all your questions answered. And meantime, let us thank Darren for a fascinating talk.